are tuned to listener-supported community radio, KVMR FM, Nevada City. It's time for the KVMR Evening News for Friday, January 27th, 2012. For their support, we'd like to thank the European Sleep Design, basing its mattress designs and materials on research into factors affecting sleep, including comfort and support, humidity levels, and ease of breathing. Located at Folsom Pavilion Shopping Center in Folsom, for more information, go to sleepdesign.com. Coming up after the news headlines, Free Speech Radio News will have reports on a new federal investigation into the foreclosure crisis, as well as a report on the Wisconsin State Assembly's efforts to pave the way for new iron mines by weakening environmental laws. George Rabane will present a commentary on President Obama's State of the Union address, and we'll close out the newscast with a movie review by Gary Chu of the new flick Carnage. Coming up after the news, we'll have this week's edition of Left, Right, and Center, and at 7 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. I'm Felton Pruitt. Now here are today's news headlines. The Christian Science Monitor reports that America's economy grew at a strengthened 2.8% annual pace in the first quarter of last year, but much of the acceleration was based on a restocking of business inventories, raising the prospect of some cooling early in 2012. The fourth quarter increase in gross domestic product, the GDP, represents a pickup from the 1.8% pace seen in the prior quarter, but it was a bit lower than what many economists had expected. The number is preliminary and will be revised a bit by the Commerce Department's Bureau of Economic Analysis in a month. GDP gains came from consumer spending as well as in the warehouse inventories, with those forces offset by declines in consumption by federal, state, and local governments. Most forecasters believe the U.S. has the momentum to avoid dipping back into recession, but that the recovery from recession remains weak, given the nation's high rate of unemployment. Confirming speculation that arose when it stopped secondary trading 2 days ago, the Chicago Tribune reports that Facebook will file documents for an initial public offering as early as next Wednesday, February 1st. The highly anticipated IPO is predicted to value the world's largest social network at $75 billion to $100 billion, according to Wall Street Journal sources. The impending IPO is expected to raise $10 billion and will be eagerly sought after by investment banks, including Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs. It could be one of the largest IPOs in U.S. history. The Los Angeles Times reports that the California Supreme Court decided today to leave the boundaries of newly drawn election districts in place for this year's state Senate races. Republican opponents of the new Senate districts had asked the state's high court to discard the plan in anticipation of a possible November ballot measure that would let voters decide the map's fate. A nonpartisan citizens commission drew the boundaries, which Republicans fear will reduce their seats in the legislature. A Republican-backed group collected signatures for a November ballot measure to abolish the new districts and asked the court to either draw new lines or use old boundaries for state Senate races in June and November. State officials are scheduled to complete a count of those signatures on February 24th. So far, fewer than half the counties, the preliminary smaller ones, have finished their counts, verifying that 78% of the signatures were valid. If that ratio holds, the referendum will qualify. The Secretary of State's office updated its count this morning, verifying that 72% of the signatures so far were valid, which would be enough to qualify if the percentage holds. The court's unanimous decision, written by Chief Justice Tani Cantil Sakaya, called the commission's maps a product of what generally appears to have been an open, transparent, and nonpartisan redistricting process. The Sacramento Bee reports that the California Air Resources Board today approved new far-reaching clean air regulations aimed at increasing the number of electric vehicles on California's roads, boost fuel efficiency, and reduce air pollution. The ARB's board voted unanimously to approve the historic regulations, which largely parallel the federal government's goal of doubling the nation's auto fuel economy standards for new cars from the current 27.3 miles per gallon to 54.5 miles per gallon by the year 2025. The new rules also set a goal of more than 1.4 million battery and hydrogen-fueled cars and trucks on state roads in 13 years, or roughly 15.4% of all the vehicles in California. The San Francisco Chronicle reports that Dick Niss, a bassist who performed for 5 decades with the folk trio Peter, Paul, and Mary and co-wrote the John Denver hit Sunshine on My Shoulders, died. He was 74 years old. Niss died Wednesday of pulmonary disease at a hospital near their home in the Hudson Valley town of Saugerties. Niss was born in Portland, Oregon, and was an original member of Denver's 1970s band. He also played with jazz greats including Herbie Hancock and Woody Herman. Active in the 1960s civil rights movement, Niss performed at benefits for a range of causes and played during the first celebration of Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday as a national holiday. Ubinet reports that Placer County voters who live in the North Auburn, Ophir, and Lone Star communities will have the opportunity in the June 5, 2012 presidential primary election to decide their level of fire and emergency medical service. On Tuesday, the Board of Supervisors approved a resolution that will put a measure on the ballot for an increase in taxes for the area. Should voters approve the increase to the special assessment, the fire district would be able to maintain current service levels at least through the fiscal year of 2020-2021. If the increase is rejected by the district's voters, firefighters' reductions will have to occur by January of next year, resulting in fewer call responses, increased response times, and potential impacts to insurance rates. The weather forecast for Nevada City, Grass Valley, and the foothills is calling for mostly clear skies this evening with a low of 34. On Saturday, it should be sunny with a high near 63 and a low of 37. Sunday's calling for mostly sunny skies with a high near 64. Sunday evening, there's a 30% chance of rain after 10 p.m. with a low around 37. And on Monday in the foothills, a 20% chance of showers, partly sunny with a high near 58. In Sacramento this evening, patchy fog and frost after 4 a.m. with a low of 33. On Saturday, sunny with a high near 62 and a low around 35. On Sunday, patchy fog and frost before 10 a.m., then mostly sunny with a high near 63 and a low around 41. And on Monday in the Sacramento area, it should be mostly sunny with a high near 61. In Truckee this evening, mostly clear with a low of 11. On Saturday, sunny with a high near 47 and a low of 16. Sunday, mostly sunny with a high near 49. Sunday night in the Truckee area, a slight chance of rain and snow showers after 10 p.m. with the snow level at 7,200 feet, lowering to 5,900 feet, with a low of 27. The chance of precipitation is 20%. And on Monday in the Truckee area, 30% chance of showers, partly sunny with a high near 44. That's the KVMR Evening News Headlines. I'm Felton Pruitt.
New details are emerging about the mortgage fraud working group that President Obama announced earlier this week in his State of the Union address. The group will investigate how mortgages were packaged over the past decade and prosecute any provable wrongdoing. The group is made up of state attorneys general, FBI agents, and federal officials from different agencies and held its first meeting today. They say they'll begin working immediately to secure relief for families facing foreclosure and hold the financial institutions accountable for their crimes. FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
When the housing bubble burst in 2008, families lost their homes, people who invested in mortgage-backed securities lost their savings, and often their pensions, and the national economy plummeted into a recession. Speaking to reporters on Friday, Housing Secretary Sean Donovan laid out the extent of the damage caused by misconduct in the financial sector.
Mortgages were sold to people who couldn't afford or understand them. Banks made huge bets and bonuses with other people's money. And we all paid a very steep price. House prices sank for 30 straight months in a row. Foreclosures climbed to record levels month after month, and by the time the worst of it was over, our economy had lost 8 million jobs.
Now, a new working group will bring together state and federal agencies to begin to address the problem by speeding up investigations already begun in certain states and launching new ones where irresponsible lending has led to widespread foreclosures. New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman has been aggressively going after financial institutions in his own state for their misleading and predatory behavior, and says he's excited to kick off a national effort to do the same.
Collectively, we have jurisdiction to go after every aspect of the artificial inflation of the housing bubble and the mortgage-backed securities bubble and the crash that brought down the economy. We have jurisdiction over everything. We have the resources, and I assure you, we have the will.
As FSRN reported on Thursday, advocates for foreclosed families are protesting a national settlement deal with five major financial institutions over the issue of robo-signing, where mortgage company employees sign foreclosure notices without properly reviewing them. The state attorneys general of California, Massachusetts, New York, and Nevada recently rejected the terms of the settlement, saying it gave banks too much immunity from future prosecution and gave too little compensation to robo-signing victims. But Housing Secretary Donovan says a revised, more focused settlement deal leaves the door open for future investigation of those same banks and potentially charging them with crimes.
We would not be standing here today if we weren't absolutely confident that the releases that are being contemplated were quite narrow, focused on the conduct that was actually investigated. And those releases are narrow enough to allow us to go forward aggressively with what we're describing today.
Whether banks are still interested in paying billions for a settlement deal that doesn't protect them from prosecution is still up in the air. Shawnee Smith, who is currently battling foreclosure on the south side of Chicago, remains opposed to a settlement and hopes her state attorney general, Lisa Madigan, will refuse to sign.
I'm afraid that if they do sign the multi-state settlement, that it won't be enough. We really need a strong settlement, and we need something that is going to help rebuild our community.
Smith says that because of predatory lending practices, including a company selling her a mortgage she didn't qualify for, and refusing to modify her loan when she lost her job, she may lose the family house where she was born and raised.
It truly has not only taken a toll on my family, but it has taken a toll on our community as a whole. So I'm just hoping that they will hold these banks accountable for how they have truly terrorized our communities.
As long as families continue to lose their homes, activists have vowed to keep advocating on their behalf. In Brooklyn, New York, on Thursday, demonstrators from Occupy Wall Street disrupted an auction of foreclosed homes. About 35 people were arrested at the action and continued to sing as they were handcuffed and escorted out of the courtroom. Both in Brooklyn and in cities across the country, activists have helped families reoccupy their foreclosed homes. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
A controversial proposal to mine iron ore near Lake Superior in Wisconsin got one step closer on Thursday. Amidst protests from environmentalists, native tribes, and concerned citizens, the Wisconsin State Assembly approved a bill to weaken environmental standards and support the construction of a huge new mine. Members of the public were removed from the room by police as lawmakers approved the measure. FSRN's Molly Stentz reports from Madison, Wisconsin.
The proposed mine would encompass a 22-mile stretch of the Pinoakee Iron Range in northern Wisconsin. It would be the largest in the state. Right now, it's hilly forest land, but in just a few short years, it could become a huge hole in the ground. Just a few miles down the road is a state park known for its waterfalls, and a few miles from that, Lake Superior, one of the largest freshwater lakes in the world. The would-be mine site also sits perched above one of the largest undeveloped coastal wetlands on the upper Great Lakes, one locals call the Everglades of the North. But Republicans say this economically depressed region needs jobs, and they've written a new law to weaken environmental protections and pave the way for the mine. The mine developer, Gjebik Taconite CEO Bill Williams, says too much money is at stake to gamble on uncertainty from state regulators, and they needed new laws to make the project work.
We are a business that has to make investment decisions on a $1.5 billion project. We need to know the rules of the road. We need to know when we will have an answer, be it yes or be it no. We need to know when that answer is coming.
Republicans are anxious to create jobs in a state that has shown consistent job losses for the past 6 months. Republican Governor Scott Walker campaigned on creating a 250,000 new jobs in the state during his first year, which has not happened. Representative Jeff Fitzgerald, a powerful and influential leader in the Republican-controlled Assembly, says this mining bill would be the biggest jobs bill they'd see all year.
We know this will create hundreds of jobs when they're constructing the mine, generational jobs after the mine's in place. These aren't jobs that can pick up and go to China or India. The iron ore is in our ground here in Wisconsin.
But many area residents are Native American tribal members who have a long history of fighting and winning against mining companies. There are four federally recognized sovereign nations in the area. They have treaty rights that say the state of Wisconsin cannot legislate away their right to land and natural resources, which include clean drinking water and a productive wild rice crop. Nearly 100 Bad River Ojibwe and other tribal members drove across the state to converge upon the Capitol this week and make that message heard. Bad River Chair Mike Wiggins Jr. says the environmental costs of the proposed mine are too high to bear, and they're prepared to sue if the mine and legislation go through.
Mining companies will be able to dump toxic mine waste into sensitive wetlands and floodplains. We're against that. It would allow the mining company to draw down water levels from rivers, lakes, and streams, groundwater aquifers. We're against that. It would allow mining corporations to contaminate groundwater and then to be off the hook if that contamination is actually deeper than 1,000 feet. Bad River's against that.
Tribal members question whether a temporary economic boost is worth the price of an industry that could forever change the ecosystem. Glenn Stoddard, an attorney for many of the tribes in northern Wisconsin, says the area's land, water, and food sources have supported Native peoples for centuries.
If all the mining proposals in the world right now at this time are granted, we will have more mining in the next 20 years than has ever been done in human history. These mines are huge, they are mechanized, and the jobs are few. Once that hole is dug and once those wetlands are gone and the streams are running backwards into a cesspool of pollution, there's no way to reverse it. There's only way to mitigate it.
Some residents in northern Wisconsin had been hopeful about the project, according to Democrat Janet Bewley, who represents the district where the mine is proposed. But she says they're not willing to accept it without safeguards for the environment and public health. She skewered Assembly Republicans at the Capitol for using her constituents as pawns in political theater.
If this is really about jobs, why didn't you write a good bill? You could have done it. We could have all won.
The mining legislation now heads to the state Senate, which Republicans control by one vote. Senate leadership wants a bill passed by March, but several Republican senators have said they're still undecided. Molly Stentz, FSRN, Madison.
And now, KVMR presents a commentary from George Rabane.
In last Tuesday's State of the Union speech, President Obama made clear that he will not run for re-election on his record. It would be a disaster if he did. With an historical congressional majority, he has been able to pass all of his programs save the cap-and-trade bill, which his own Democrats killed. In spite of this, the resulting numbers are damning. At a little above 60%, the fraction of productive-age Americans in the workforce, working or looking for work, is the lowest ever. Even with population growth, our economy has fewer jobs today than in January 2009. And this after the so-called stimulus spending has increased our national debt by over $4 trillion, or about 40%, in just 3 years, and costing $1.5 million for every job that the administration claims to have created. Radio does not allow us to pause here for a minute or two to absorb this little statistic. Putting a ribbon around the whole thing, our employment rate at 8.5% is still higher than the 7.9% that the president inherited. While the major costs of Obamacare, hanging tax hikes, and the new costly EPA regulations have yet to kick in, running on his record is a definite no-no. But not to worry. The political pyrotechnics locker is still chuck full of good stuff to loft into the air, there to create great eye candy in the sky and take the voters' mind off our real problems here on the ground. The first thing to launch is the fair share argument for the vilified 1% with poster child none other than leading Republican contender Mitt Romney. Before considering anything as complex as fair share, we recall that, according to the National Center for Educational Statistics, in the aggregate, the audience for this message is surprisingly illiterate, disinterested, almost totally innumerate, and a stranger to the issues. In short, they comprise a population that is vulnerable to what we may call soundbite bait. Campaign funding, war chests, and gotcha politics promise again to carry the day. Actually, the average voter doesn't think twice about the notion of fairness or fair share. Don't we all know what is fair? Aren't we all born with the same dipstick that measures fairness? Well, actually, no. There's a whole area of decision science that deals with fairness and what are called fair division algorithms. It's quite an important and complex area, much more than the familiar pie division rule. One cuts, the other chooses. When we talk about taking money from someone by threat of force and then giving it to others, the ground can start shaking. The folks with their hands out consider only the dollar amounts to be taxed, which all look huge and appear to be more than any fair-minded person needs. But please, play a little game with me. If you had to decide between keeping, say, $10,000 in treasury bills or taking an investment risk that can double or lose the whole thing, you'd want to know the odds favoring your success. If the odds worked out to 9 out of 10, then you'd probably invest. But with success at only 1 out of 10, you'd keep the treasury bills. Somewhere in between, there is a threshold that, if exceeded, you'd invest. And that threshold is different for different people, depending on their situation. So let's say your threshold for the deal that doubles the $10,000 is 7 out of 10, and you decide that the actual odds of success are about that. You've done your homework. You're ready to cash in the treasury and put it into the business venture. But then you hear on the radio that the feds have changed the tax code and/or regulatory environment so that your reward, instead of doubling your investment, is reduced to making just 80%. Please note here, the odds for success are still a little above 7 out of 10. That hasn't changed, but your reward has. Your decision to invest was based on both the risk and the reward. With the reward being reduced from a return of $10,000 to just under $8,000, you decide not to make the investment. To you, it no longer is a fair deal for the money you would have to place at that level of risk. Perhaps to someone else it might still be, but you get the idea. Most certainly the workers and those on the dole who were expecting your investment to create jobs and pay taxes on profits, both those groups of people still think that your $8,000 return would be utterly fair. For them, you're just a selfish rich guy who doesn't care for the middle class or those less fortunate. And that's why they will vote for politicians who promise to go after even the $10,000 treasury bill that you have already paid taxes on and squirreled away. Welcome to 2012. My name is Rebane, and I also expand on these and other themes in my Union columns and on georgerebane.com, where this transcript appears. These opinions are not necessarily shared by KVMR. Thank you for listening.
And now KVMR presents a movie review from Gary Chu.
Occasionally, a play is good enough that it will eke itself into a motion picture. Since plays are rather static, it's common that when they're made for the cinema, people who seldom go to the theater complain about the movie being different from most other films they see. That can be said of Roman Polanski's new film, Carnage. As a play, it won the 2009 Best Play Tony. On stage, it was known as Le Dieu du Carnage, God of Carnage, written by Yasmina Reza, the Paris-born Jewish playwright-actress-screenwriter of Iranian-Hungarian parentage. Miss Reza and Polanski wrote the screenplay. The first 10 minutes of the picture had almost put me in a snit for what looked to be a slow-rolling 90 minutes or so to come, when all of a sudden, it didn't matter it was a movie of a play I was seeing. As Leon Russell once wrote in his best song, the words got in the way. Well, actually, it was the dialogue. And it was Jodie Foster, Kate Winslet, Christoph Waltz, and John C. Reilly up there being the only characters in this work that speaks volumes about the real possibility that many contemporary people are determined to be so terribly civilized that they're savage. I knew that what we had up there on the screen in this cinema was the theater at work. I settled in. Who's afraid of a little carnage when it takes place in a nicely appointed middle-class apartment overlooking Brooklyn, I ask. There live Mr. and Mrs. Longstreet. Foster plays Penelope. Riley is Michael. Visiting the Longstreets for the first time, the couples having never met, are Mr. and Mrs. Cowan. Winslet is Nancy. Valtz is Alan. Penelope, or Penny, is into art and saving Darfur. Michael sells products for the home. He's done well. Penny, sort of a liberal, wannabe art patroness, works part-time in a bookstore. She's even co-authored a book, and it comes out later after a few scotches that Michael might listen to right-wing talk radio when no one's around. But he's a nice guy. A little higher up the money chain, Nancy doesn't work, and Alan is an attorney who gets called on his cell every 3 or 4 minutes regarding a legal matter connected with one of his clients, a pharmaceutical firm, and the sale of a particular medicine that could be dangerous to the health of a patient using it. And you'll never guess what medicine an elderly Brooklyn woman whose son sells home products takes as a prescription from her doctor. What brought on this afternoon chat at the Longstreets is that their son, Zachary, has been smacked in the face with a stick by the Cowan's son, Ethan. It happened in the schoolyard, and Zach sustained incisor damage, otherwise he's good to go. The Longstreets and the Cowans are rational human beings, living urbane, responsible lives. Each of them only wants to do the right thing. So how could anything go wrong? Stuff starts going wrong about 10 minutes in, just when I was trying to pull myself out of the snit that this movie was sure to be a sluggish, static stage play put to film. This brings me to a point I like to make now and then. Dude, it's the story that's important. Then the cinemagic or the great film director auteur stuff follows right behind it. Some movie experts tend to forget that. Taking one more shot at this point, have you ever seen a really visually astounding film that's well directed in the many ways it takes, but has a script that sucks? I have. Digression finished. Carnage really gets terribly ugly, and you get to laugh much of the way. Nancy barfs on expensive art books. Alan's cell gets thrown into the bowl of water just under the real tulips. In the living room, Penny gets aggressively physical in a non-amorous way with her husband. And Michael gets out his 17-year-old scotch for everybody in this party of four. As stated earlier, he is a nice guy. All it is just really great actors really getting into some really juicy roles and probably having a ball while on the shoot that was done in Paris, yet through the windows looks like Brooklyn. And don't forget the really fine music at the top and bottom of the film, composed by Alexandra Desplat. My only criticism of Carnage is that the role of Alan should have been played with a little less snark. The words Alan speaks do the talking. And the script is a little limp, keeping the Cowans there so long for the melee. Maybe a storm outside could have kept them there. I think I would have walked out of the Longstreet's digs about 10 minutes after being let in. Unless, of course, Liz and Dick had been the couple who'd asked me over. Mr. Albee, your cell phone is buzzing. I'm Gary Chu, down in the valley.
Well, that's going to do it for our newscast for this evening. The KVMR Evening News is produced by the staff and volunteers of KVMR Radio. We'd like to thank Paul Emery, George Rabane, and Gary Chu for their help in preparing this evening's newscast. Coming up next, it's this week's edition of Left, Right, and Center, and at 7 o'clock, it's Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! I'm Felton Pruitt. Y'all have a wonderful weekend.